Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. To celebrate Paul McCartney's 80th birthday, over four episodes I'll be speaking to a potpourri of delicious guests who'll be choosing their favourite Fab Macca song. We'll also be hearing from lots of Egg Pod listeners who picked a song that means the most to them. So, let's get part two underway. Take it away, Egg Podders.
To lead a better life, I need my love to be here.
Hello, my name's Hugh. The Paul McCartney song I choose is Here, There and Everywhere. I was really nervous the last time I flew on a plane, so I decided to stick my head between my knees, put Here, There and Everywhere on repeat, and just listen to it while we taxied around and got ready for takeoff. And every time I listened, I heard something new. Different parts of the song stood out. It's so simple, so short, but it did exactly the job I needed it to do. And I'm incredibly grateful for that. And to Paul for making such a beautiful song that helped me do something that I should have been able to do without any help. Yeah, thank you, Paul.
Hello, my name's Donna, and my Paul McCartney song of choice is Lovely Rita. Now, if somebody was to ask me what my favourite Beatles song of all time was, I probably wouldn't say Lovely Rita. But out of a handful of songs, certainly one of those that I've played the most, especially in the last couple of years. And I know John had a hand in the lyric writing, but it's predominantly Paul's song, his lead vocal, and McCartney's fingerprints are all over it. And I just think it's wonderful. I find sonically, it's so uplifting and it's so funny and clever. And the way the lyrics are constructed, the play on words, the kind of music hall Max Miller innuendo, the cheekiness of it. I love it. And like all great Beatles songs, they sort of somehow reach out through the speakers and grab you and take you somewhere better. And whenever I hear this song, it never fails to make me feel better and make me happy. And that's a wonderful thing.
Penny Lane, there is a barber showing photographs of every head he's had the pleasure to know. And all the people that come and go, stop and say hello.
Hi, Chris. I'd like to talk about Penny Lane. Penny Lane is a remarkable song in many ways. It has a melody that rises and falls just beautifully, but the thing that for me really sets it apart is the chord structure. First of all, it starts off in the key of B major, which is certainly not typical, but the chords move around quite a bit. But then when it goes to In His Pocket Is a Portrait of the Queen, that's a B minor, something that that is certainly not typical. The Beatles have often played with that major and minor thing, but Penny Lane does that so well. And then what is just so spectacular is when it goes to the Penny Lane is in my ears and in my eyes, it actually changes keys to A major, a step down from the key that the verse is in. Typically, if you want to add an emotional lift to a song, you'll go up a step. But in this case, Paul goes down a step, and the result is just spectacular.
Please don't wake me up too late. Tomorrow comes, and I will not be late.
This is Tom from Antwerp in Belgium. The song I would like to put forward is the Goodbye Home demo, which you can find on the Abbey Road Super Deluxe version. Originally, Paul wrote this for Mary Hopkin, whose version I also like, but there's something about this home demo that I just can't let go. I just love the idea of listening to this song coming straight from Paul's home to our ears, right after he wrote the song. It's a window into his writing process. It feels effortless, very personal, and wonderfully executed, especially considering it's a home demo for a song he intended for another artist. This version starts off soft and lovely, picks up pace as it goes along, and ends full of melancholy and sweetness. As a song, it has a bit of an older traditional folk feel, but with such a great sense of what makes a pop song work. And the guitar playing and singing is excellent as well. When I play this for my daughter when she was about 3 years old, you could see how much it immediately resonated. It's been one of my favorites ever since.
Bow, bow, bow. Hi, this is Emma Burnell, and I am here to tell you why I absolutely and without reservation adore the Frog Chorus. I don't believe in guilty pleasures. If you like something, you like something, and I love this song. It makes me happy. It quite often pops on my headphones as I'm walking around. I do a lot of walking in East London where I live, and I have a terrible habit of singing along as I walk around East London. And there is nothing more joyful than walking the streets of the mean streets of Leighton, going boom, 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 bye, looking at the faces as they respond to you. Sometimes music's important, sometimes being made happy is important. And when music makes you happy, that for me is great.
Songwriter, multi-instrumentalist and producer Catherine Ann Davis, aka The Anchoress, what song have you picked?
I have picked We All Stand Together. I know, a deeply unfashionable choice. I just thought, what song kind of resonates with me the most? Or what was my introduction to him really as well? Rather than trying to appear to be effortlessly cool, which obviously I do in the rest of my life, I thought, you know, why not be honest about it and talk about the gate? It's like a gateway song for me to music and to songwriting and production and arrangement and everything. So yeah, it felt like the most natural choice to me. You know, it's not his best song, of course, objectively speaking, but for me, it's without that, I don't think that I would be doing what I do now for my job. So
really?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that, really.
What an impact, blimey. I've been doing a lot of these and the amount of people who've stood up for We All Stand Together, because it did take a bit of abuse when it came out, and subsequently for years after it was used almost as an insult.
Well, I kind of came to it obviously later. You know, I wasn't around when it came out, but my sister had a DVD of it. And we used to have this little ritual between us before our parents got up on a Saturday morning, that we would sit and watch this DVD, and it had, Frog Song Chorus on it, and then it had like some of the Linda McCartney stuff with the animated videos on it.
Yeah.
And so we kind of had this like Saturday morning ritual that we would like rush downstairs before they wake up and put it on and watch it. So I probably have seen that film and heard that piece of music probably upwards of 1,000 times.
Wow.
And it has like a really strongly nostalgic effect on me. Like I watched it the other day with my nephews and I felt really quite emotional and quite tearful, because it just really reminds me of being, I guess I probably was about 3 or 4 when I first saw it. And then I watched it like all the way through to being, you know, probably like 12 years old, like every weekend. Being autistic, I'm a person that really loves routine. So this is why it became like a part of our weekend routine. And yeah, I really do believe that it's responsible for my kind of deep love of music, but also my wanting to unpack music. Because I think on the surface, it's a song that feels like quite flimsy and throwaway. But the way that it's presented, in that he kind of, it's a little bit like a kind of a meta song, in that it performs the act of writing itself and the act of arrangement in the way that each of the sections unfold and the kind of the different elements kind of come in and repeat. Like you almost kind of, it's like a lesson in how to write a song and how to arrange it. You know, here's the bass line, here's the kind of little kind of refrain that's going to come back in, then we're going to put these two things together. And it's a little bit like that other kids song when it kind of goes through the different orchestra parts. And I think I can only kind of pinpoint me listening to that every Saturday morning as the reason why I became really interested in how songs are put together. And that became my obsession in my kind of preteens and early teenage years. And I can't think of another one of his songs that kind of does that. Obviously, I don't know how much of that is George Martin, because it's George Martin arrangement, isn't it, I think?
Yes, yeah. Well, there's a demo Paul did in August 1980, and it's just him and Denny Lane at Rood Studios in Campbelltown. And it's basically the arrangement that we hear, and it's Paul doing all the voices. He's doing the voices of the bees and the orchestration. It's pretty well there. So George did the score for it.
Right,
but Paul,
I see.
Had pretty well everything there.
Win or lose, sink or swim, one thing is certain, we'll never give in. Side by side.
hand in hand we all stand together.
Yeah, because I think, it's one of those kind of misnomers, isn't it? You know, he can't read music and therefore he couldn't have been responsible for the arrangements. But actually, and I think that is, again, why it appeals to children, because it is quite primal in the way that, God, that's not to diss him in any way, of course, but of course it's going to appeal to children because the naivety of the arrangement is something that resonates with you, even if you have no prior knowledge or understanding of music. I think that's what makes it really inviting. You've got the kind of bum, 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 bum. There's your bass line, and all kids can kind of sing along to that. And then I remember just loving, my sister would carry on singing the bum, 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 and then I'd go, aye. and then I would do the canon on top. And so it became something that we kind of interacted with. And I guess unconsciously we're learning to arrange and we're learning to put layers on top of each other, to overdub, essentially. It's such a fascinating arrangement for me, in that it does enact what you do when you are arranging a song that you've written. And it unfolds in this really beautiful way across the course of the song. And obviously you can't really uncouple it from the visual as well, which I think equally does that. And even down to, I was watching it the other day in preparation for this, and that moment when the fish kind of comes out and does the little kind of falsetto operatic moment. And it's almost like it's kind of taking you through a journey of like 20th century music. You've got the Gershwin-esque kind of parody, which I'm assuming it's supposed to consciously be, like an American in Paris style, isn't it? Where you get those kind of beautiful sweeping strings. And I just think it's absolutely genius in the way that it presents itself as being, as I say, like an incredibly flimsy, whimsical song. But actually what he's doing is inviting you to walk through and discover all of these things that are incredibly joyful and make you curious to find out, well, where does that come from? This little bit of opera, this little bit of Gershwin, this little bit of soul. I just think I talk about all the time how I just think he's a genius. But I just can't underestimate the importance of that happening at such a young age. It's almost like hooking children in the drug of writing, the drug of arrangement. And for me, I've been addicted ever since. So it's,
As you say, it's a brilliant arrangement. And I think George, like you say, the orchestration and the score is beautiful as well. That's pure George. It's very Yellow Submarine. It reminds me of the score that he did for that.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting song to compare it to, though, isn't it? Because for me, Yellow Submarine is a novelty track, and I don't by choice listen to it, you know, and I don't really enjoy it particularly. Whereas the Frog Song has got these kind of hidden depths, I feel. I think emotionally as well as a lyric. It's not got that kind of that psychedelic sort of, I guess it would have been from the Goo. So I'm not too sure on the era of comedy that they're kind of referencing.
Oh, Yellow Submarine, yeah, definitely, yeah.
Whereas the Frog Song is more kind of emotionally authentic, and it feels like there's a kind of a genuine desire to tap into an emotional core there. You know, we all stand together. It's even in terms of what the animation is depicting, the relationship between the father and the son, the young lovers, the family, the wider community, that's not, we all live in a yellow submarine or yellow tub of margarine, as my dad used to sing to make us laugh. So I do think it's got an emotional sophistication that's lacking in Yellow Submarine, and for me makes it kind of stand apart from the sort of novelty Beatles tracks. I think that's a misnomer to think of it in that way. Here I am elevating it to the level of, his greatest work, obviously. Because I almost did think, you know, am I going to choose something from Ram, because that's a really important record to me. But it's only an important record to me because I binged on a Frog Song Chorus every Saturday for probably 10 years.
Well, it is an important, influential song then.
For me, it is, you know, in my personal history. And I do wonder, however, you know, how many other kids out there from the 90s were kind of raised on that too. You know, it was a time when the Beatles were kind of becoming cool again. I mean, I think they had their years in the wilderness, the rise of Oasis and Britpop. It kind of became something that people were referencing again. And I think that was very much echoed in what parents were exposing their kids to and what was also cool to enjoy and talk about in the playground. And, you know, I remember singing at school choir arrangements of Beatles songs and it becoming a thing again that you would know all of the Beatles songbook. And it wasn't, you know, old music that was looked down upon, that it was something that was part of a living, breathing canon that was happening now, you know, with all the cool bands that were coming through. So, yeah, I think it wouldn't surprise me that there are tons of other musicians of my age that probably have similar memories of being raised on that.
Yeah. What I love as well, because we've mentioned it a few times on different podcasts, but Paul's voice, his ability to do different voices. There's one here that I've never heard him do on any other song. People will correct me, I'm sure. But when he does the operatic, "You'll get it right," that is authentic opera singing. It's astonishing.
It's brilliant, isn't it? And when you compare it to something like Prince, where obviously Prince did that, but he was using kind of, you know, he'd slow down the tape, fasten it up to do Camille, yeah, or whatever. But you've got kind of Paul McCartney just mimicking the voice. And again, that's so important that it's part of the animation, because obviously he does all the voices in the animation apart from the two, is it June Whitfield and...
Winston Davis.
Yeah, but there's, you know, but he's doing, you know, the children's voices, the kind of funny voices as well. And it's, yeah. I love it. It makes me smile, like talking about it, as you can see. It's such a lovely memory that, yeah, it becomes quite, you know, when you look back at the things that have influenced you and why you've ended up doing what you've done in your life, or why you end up sounding like you do in your life. And I think I talked about this on the Rock and Tours podcast recently, that I hadn't realised until recently that the music that I make is an exact kind of amalgamation of my parents' record collection, you know, the prog rock from my dad and the kind of classic songwriting and easy listening kind of, you know, voice of Karen Carpenter. It was never something that I'd consciously thought about, and now I'm obviously unpacking this whole Frog Song Chorus thing. I'm wondering if that is a little bit in everything that I do, in terms of, you know, the way I approach arrangement, and I do a lot of funny voices, or as T.S. Eliot said, you know, he do the police, yeah, in different voices, and that's something that I've done, like tracks like Popular, and all across my first album, actually there was a lot of that. Yeah, it's, yeah, unconscious Paul McCartney.
Who'd have thought? I mean, even the history of the song is, I find, really interesting, because it goes pretty well right back to the breakup of the Beatles.
Oh, really?
Because Paul, yeah, once they'd split, Paul set up MPL and bought the rights to Rupert. And there's a quote which I love. He says, "I remember telling John Lennon about it and he encouraged me to have a go, which was great." So John Lennon was aware of the Frog Chorus, which is, I love. And throughout October and November 1980, recordings took place at Air Studios with George Martin. And from 81 to 83, Paul worked with, obviously, Jeff Dunbar, who animated it, to do the film. So it was a long, old process. And it seems to be, talking to different people on this, he tends to do that. He tends to work on a project and then he might sit on it for a few years and then unleash it when he feels the need is right. So he's kind of aware of his own legacy, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's probably actually more common than people think, in the way that you kind of produce and make work as well. I think, you know, there's that kind of ridiculous notion of musical genius, that you just sit down and a song pops out in 10, 15 minutes and that's it, it's written, or it came to you in a dream, you know, like yesterday. But actually, I do think it's quite a common creative process to let things percolate for a while and then to know when the right moment is for them to kind of make themselves known as well. Like, and obviously you can't imagine him having done this as part of the Beatles. It couldn't have come out, you know, just as they'd split, because it would be such an anathema to sort of their brand, I guess, and what, and their listeners as well. I think it's almost as if you think about it, would he have been releasing it at the time where a lot of his listeners would have had kids and would therefore have been much more kind of open-minded, yeah, and receptive to this? It's lovely, isn't it? It's like a reflection of his own kind of personal life as well, and that kind of domesticity. Yeah. And it sort of feels like a little bit of a partner song to me, for, you know, like when I'm 64 or something like that. I always think there's a little bit of a yearning for him, obviously, for what he was not able to have as a child, you know, with losing his mom, and the yearning for that domestic, the blissful domestic unit, which obviously he was able to replicate then finally with his own family. Maybe I'm overly psychoanalyzing this. But there is a genuine warmth, and I do feel like there is a genuine warmth and emotional core to the song that I think its kind of critical reception hasn't always done justice to.
Absolutely. Catherine Ann Davis, what does this song mean to you?
It means the beginning of music for me. That's a very short answer.
But very deep. And finally, Paul McCartney, 80. Why do you think Paul's music has endured for all these years?
I think his music has endured because he's not been afraid to kind of magpie from lots of different threads of, you know, musical history, and but also to be incredibly honest about that magpieing process. You know, I don't think he's anyone that sets himself up to be a sort of self-proclaimed genius. And I think that we as the kind of British listening public aren't too keen on that either. So it kind of sits well with our general expectations for our rock stars. But I mean, the simple answer is because he's a bloody fine songwriter, isn't it? That's the simple answer. And I feel quite sad in a way to think of him at 80, because obviously it reminds us of mortality and that he won't be here forever. And I'm really desperately keen to try and see him live while it's still possible. But yeah, what an incredible achievement. I'm sure he can't think about it too much, because how could you keep making music as he does and keep moving forwards if you're constantly looking back? But I think it is a nice moment for us to look back and think how incredibly lucky we are to have lived at the same time as him.
Catherine, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's been really lovely to go down memory lane and talk about this song, and remind myself to not be so embarrassed about loving these trivial, quote-unquote, things. We all stand together.
Hi Chris, my name's Chris Prescott, and the song I would pick would be I'm Down. I think what you get with I'm Down is a nod back to the Beatles' Hamburg days, one of the kind of great live bouncy songs. Obviously it's a rarity in the catalogue, being the B-side to Help. I think McCartney's performance is stellar. There's lots of things setting him apart from the other bands at the time, but when you hear this and you hear this kind of the gravelly falsetto, that voice that not many other people could match, his Little Richard, as he would put it himself, really helps him stand out. And I think there's great performance points from the other lads as well. You've got Ringo, the Ringo swing is there, but the fills are coming straight off of, like, What Did I Say by Ray Charles. You've got a typical George guitar solo, and the legendary Lennon performance on the organ that we see at Shea Stadium as well. So I think it's a bit of a rarity, lots to talk about. I'd be up for it, mate. Thank you.
No one to tell me what to do, no one to hold my hand. Bellamy's got a lot to do, and I hope that you'll understand.
Hello, I'm Jack Kibblewhite, and I'd like to tell you why Mr. Bellamy is the great Overlooked McCartney track. A song about a man up a tree, it's in the fine Macca tradition of vignette songs, sitting proudly alongside Eleanor Rigby, no less. It has fantastic counterpoint vocals and a crazily catchy lolloping piano line that brings to mind the similarly tumbling keyboards of the theme tune to Succession. And it's gifted with a beautiful nuanced production, including another Macca favourite, Serendipity. In this case, the shutter snap of a photographer who just so happened to be in the studio that day. Catch that at 16 seconds. But best of all, it's a shining example of Paul's use of vernacular. Steady lads, easy does it. A key trait in any great Macca composition. I hope Mr. Bellamy stays up there until he gets what he deserves, which is, of course, a place in the accepted upper pantheon of McCartney songs. Check my machine.
Check. My machine. At the moment, my McCartney listening life is completely dominated by McCartney 2. It was the first Beatles solo album I bought with my first wages from my job as a fish and chip server in Little Asties in Cardiff. And then later, when I bought McCartney 2 on CD, Check My Machine is there. And if you saw Paul's joy on 321 McCartney when he's rocking out to Check My Machine, it's wonderful. He loves it so much, and so do I. And if Paul McCartney wants to jam out for 5 minutes just to check his machines and then release it as a B-side, then he can. He can do whatever he wants. He's Paul McCartney.
Hi, I'm Angela, and the track I picked is Check My Machine. It's perhaps not my all-time favorite McCartney track, but certainly one that translates all my thoughts about Paul as a musician and, to some extent, as a person too. It's creative, it's innovative, it's brave, and it's not tremendously self-aware, which in this case is a great thing because it was released at a time that Paul McCartney wasn't exactly perceived as the hippest artist around. He didn't care. He did his thing, released what many thought was a very weird song, put it out as a single, and boy, does that track swing. And swings so much, in fact, that in my native country of Brazil, Check My Machine is often played by samba rock artists and appreciated by audiences that don't even follow Paul McCartney or associate that song to him. If you want to know more about this phenomenon, go to YouTube now and type Check My Machine and the words samba rock and be amazed by the number of South American artists covering this song and playing it live in their gigs. Is Paul McCartney even aware that electro rock and hip hop and samba rock audiences love this track so much? I don't think so. And that's the mind-boggling reach of Paul McCartney as an artist. And we're so lucky to have him around.
How kind of you to think of me when I was out of sorts. It really meant a lot to be in someone else's thoughts.
Hello, Chris and fellow Ed Potters. This is Gabe Rosa from Hartford, Connecticut. A daunting task this is to choose one song from Paul McCartney's vast, brilliant catalog. Shall I choose a song that was a worldwide number one when I was born? We can work it out. Or perhaps the first record I bought when I was 8 years old, the Band on the Run single. Or maybe something from Tug of War, the first album I knew the release date of and eagerly anticipated getting on the day it dropped. After some deliberation, I landed on How Kind of You from Chaos and Creation in the Backyard. This song perfectly encapsulates what I have to say to the man who helped provide the soundtrack to my life. Through the highs and the lows of life, Paul's words and music have been there to provide joy, comfort, and the will to carry on. A line from the song best sums it up, as someone who was there for me. Paul's been there for me, and I'm sure to everyone who's listening here. How kind of you, Paul, to share your otherworldly talents with us. How lucky we are to share this little planet we're playing on with you, Paul. Thanks for everything and happy 80th birthday.
Welcome to our island. Glad you came to call. Now you've made yourself at home. You're welcome to us all.
We are simple people. Why are we this way? This is what we always say. It's the way that we bang on the bongo. It's the way that we bang on the big bass drum. The way that we sing in a song. Bass drop, big island hum.
Jeff Lloyd, when I contacted you to do this, you replied, definitely. I'm sure Tropic Island Hum has already gone, so I'll have to think. I'll have to have a think which one. Then a few days later, you sent, I was initially being facetious, but I'd really like to do Tropic Island Hum. I think we can have fun talking about the odd projects Paul McCartney has on the go at any one time. His love of an accent and how good he is with kids. I think it's one that most people wouldn't know either. Over to you.
Well, I mean, it's exactly that. So I thought I was being a smart ass, really, saying mentioning Tropic Island Hum, because it's, I think, even to a lot of people who would consider themselves having great knowledge of Paul's oeuvre, it's not one that would immediately spring to mind. It was from an animation, and the story of it and how long it took to surface from inception is quite the thing. But something, I'm sure you're the same. When people make the joke about Frog Chorus, I just roll my eyes, because it's supposed to be a children's song, and it's a great children's song. It's a great bit of animation that succeeds on those terms.
And Tropic Island Hum is kind of more of the same, only less well known. So, I mean, is the best place to start by talking about what it is, how it came about?
Yes.
Because it's been Who's stuck in my head. This is the thing, it's been stuck in my head ever since I mentioned it. So I just want to say it's not my favourite Paul McCartney song, but I wouldn't want to choose. I wouldn't want to choose my favourite either, as we've talked about before. That's an impossible task. So the animator that Paul worked with on the Rupert and the Frog song and a number of other projects is a guy called Jeff Dunbar. And Paul wrote this song called Tropic Island Hum and got the idea in his head that they should do another animation. And that's what this is. It really forms the center of another one of these short films. It's about a squirrel called Wirral the Squirrel who ends up on an island that is some kind of animal sanctuary for animals who have escaped being hunted and eaten. So the old vegetarian message is strong in the film. But it is a charming bit of animation. It looks like kind of classic 1940s animation. There's even a nod to Bambi in it. It is quite evocative of the Rupert and the Frog song in places. And then the song itself is quite something. It appears to have been recorded over a number of years at locations including George Martin's Air Studios, where George Martin orchestrated it. It was engineered by Jeff Emerick. Also, bits of it were done at Hog Hill Mill, Paul's own studio. And it seems like it was started in about 1987 and maybe completed as a song around 1994, 95, not long before the anthology. And then the film was finished around 97, but it didn't see the light of day until 2004. And then I think eventually it came out on a DVD, maybe another 10 years after that. So I think it's a very kind of telling glimpse into what must be on the shelf and how many projects he has on the go at any given time.
Oh, absolutely. It was released as a single in September 2004, and it actually got to number 21 in the charts.
Did it really?
Which is quite a surprise. But there's so many of these songs that he has in the can that he can call on, he can do anything with. And I think the reason this was delayed was, sadly, Linda passed away, and it was released on the 20th anniversary of We All Stand Together. I'm wondering if he sat on that and thought, yeah, I'll use that as an anniversary thing. But it's an amazing piece of animation. It's one of the most catchy songs. You know, you think Yellow Submarine is catchy. Now listen to this.
It's really catchy. And I don't even know what style would you describe it as? It's kind of orchestrated, but almost big bandy. And it jumps around and Paul is singing in. I would place it as a Caribbean accent for a lot of the song in character. There's a bison in the film who seems to speak in quite a posh English voice and yet sing in a Jamaican accent, which I haven't quite been able to work out. But there's a whole chorus on it, and Paul does almost every voice.
Playing in the sunshine, lots of sea and sand.
It's jolly nice in paradise.
Lordy, ain't life grand?
Everyone is happy, joining in the fun. Do it like we've always done. It's the way that we
There's a woman who sings on it, and it's a jazz singer called Marion Montgomery, an American jazz singer. She had some fame maybe in the 40s. 50s, and then she moved to the UK. She married Laurie Holloway, who was the musical director on a lot of BBC shows, including Michael Parkinson's show. And then she became like the house singer on Parky's chat show. And in fact, if you ever seen the John Lennon Parkinson appearance, she sings a version of Love on that. That's her. And here she is years later turning up on this very silly song about the way that we bang a de bongo and the way that we, the way we shake the shaker.
There's a comment, because John Lennon, after that performance, says how much he loves it as well.
Mm. I don't really know very much about her at all. It's not a name that's familiar to me. It's not really my type of music. But then that throws up all these questions about how did that come about? So we know Paul and Michael Parkinson are friends. Is it through that? I mean, this whole other life, the circles he's moving in, the collaborations that go on in that studio of his, it makes you wonder, like, how often is it that he has somebody to stay for the weekend or has someone over for dinner and then they, you know, drive off to his studio and you know, bang something out like they did with Yoko that time.
Yeah, you get the impression he can, you know, he can phone whoever he wants. They're going to, he knows they're going to say yes.
Yeah. You know, it's a playground. That place seems like it's a playground to him. And I don't know, a bit like a laboratory and somewhere that, you know, he has to go to keep busy. There's that bit in Get Back where he's kind of repeating the mantra of you've got to achieve something every day. And
yeah,
things like this, little oddities like this, if you think of how a rock star fills their time, sometimes it can feel a bit bleak, but Paul McCartney, I don't think, fills his time in a bleak way. I think he likes his leisure, he likes his holidays, but I think he loves having bits of stuff on the go. And this is a great example of that. You know, it's something that he would have dipped in and out of over a number of years, especially when you think about what animation is and what a slow process that is. And again, this film is beautiful, really, because it's the old-fashioned animation where it's all hand-drawn and done on individual cells, and it's an homage to that era of Disney. And, you know, you just imagine him over the course of a couple of years spending a few days here, a few days there, going in, hanging out with Jeff Dunbar and his team. I also love that Jeff Dunbar is somebody that he seems to have kept around for such a long time. It says something about him. I think Paul, his engineers, yeah, just the fact that he's lived in the same houses for so long, it says something. I'm not quite sure what, but it says something about his character.
Yeah, it's a generational thing as well. I mean, we're talking about She's Leaving Home, you know, 2 years after Hope I Die Before I Get Old. He's singing a song for both parents and children. And I think this is kind of like the Abbey Road suite for children. There's so much going on. You know, if Abbey Road, Pinky and Perky did Abbey Road, this would be on it, I think.
And it's just big as well. If you listen to this song, it's not got that thin sound when somebody's just phoned something in. You can tell it's something he's lavished attention on over, you know, this long period of time. And then to sit on this for that long and not really know what to do with it, I find it so interesting that, you know, his archive there must be anything from sketches he's made on his iPhone to fully blown orchestrated unreleased tracks.
Yeah, obviously we're both of a similar age, I guess, but you remember the abuse that We All Stand Together got at the time. Throughout, I think one thing, you know, we need to mention, throughout the 70s and the 80s, McCartney was seen pretty well as a joke in the serious music press.
Yeah.
You know, but this is a backlash of pretty well 20 years of insults, effectively.
Yes.
Release the children's songs.
Yeah, but if you think about Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Yeah.
As well, it's funny because you do get the impression with him that he is sensitive to criticism and that he's aware of criticism, and yet he just goes where his instinct takes him, and his instinct takes him all over the place. So I think that's a strange combination in a way, to be both kind of hyper aware and hypersensitive to what people say about you, and just to not care, and just whatever idea or whim pops into your head, to follow it and see where it goes.
Yeah, I sent you a link. I don't know if you saw it. There's a beautiful thing on YouTube. If you Google Paul McCartney fairy tale, and it's audio of him singing a fairy tale for his kids, and it's just the most amazing piece of audio, because he's kind of telling a story with the piano. I interviewed Julia Baird recently, and she was saying that Julia, her mum, used to do the same thing, but he's doing that for his kids, and they're singing along. He's so catchy, and he's got this instinct where he targets a particular, you know, right, kids, I'm going to do a kids thing, and he just does it.
Yeah, really. It's funny, isn't it? Because, he's always, or for a long time, spoken about his love of children, and when he tells the well-worn anecdote about writing Hey Jude and John's relationship with Julian, you know, he'd say, being from this kind of family, I'm used to being around kids and playing with kids. John didn't know how to play with kids, so his relationship wasn't quite the same. And then you watch Get Back, you watch the days where Linda brings Heather in, and Paul is amazing with her. But it was so surprising to me as well to see just how lovely John was too. Because I'd had this idea in my head, I think because of, you know, that version of him that Paul had talked about, that John was uncomfortable around kids. But actually thinking about it, you see a Magical Mystery Tour as well, don't you?
With Little Nicola.
Yeah. So, I just thought they were all so wonderful with her, really. It's one of the joys of those films. And, you know, you get a bit of it in Let It Be as well, but just seeing Heather and how they play with her. And I think for Paul, as a rock star, when, I don't know, being an elder statesman of rock, there's a certain kind of way of holding yourself or presenting you. Like, it'd be difficult to imagine Keith Richards publicly embracing that side of himself. You know, maybe he is great with his extended family and the generations and so on. But I just really think it reflects well on Paul McCartney as a human being, that not only is he like that, but he's unafraid to be like that, you know, in his work and in public.
I've asked this of every guest, and this is your fault, but Jeff Lloyd, what does Tropic Island Hum mean to you?
it's proof, if we needed it, that Paul McCartney doesn't struggle to come up with a melody that can lodge itself in your brain. I also think I just enjoy seeing how much he enjoys playing with mimicry and voices, and he does pretty much all the characters. There's a variety of different accents, as I mentioned, that come out in there. There's Wirral the Squirrel, he really ramps up the Scouse. There's also I think perhaps something akin to a Yorkshire accent in there. It's a bit like, do you remember around Christmas, there was that video of him playing around with, I don't know if they were Instagram or Snapchat filters.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
He just loves it. He can't help himself.
Finally, Jeff Lloyd, Paul McCartney at 80. Why do you think Paul's music has endured for all these years?
I mean, the simple answer is it's just good enough to have endured for all these years. It's good enough. Its cultural significance is so huge, and he has thrown a lot of energy at maintaining his own relevance. I think possibly partly for a sense of his own legacy, but more than anything, I think because he likes to work, he likes to do stuff, he likes to pursue an idea, and that is why something as silly and as throwaway as this is a conversation that we're able to have.
Jeff Lloyd, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. To drop it, Island Hum. Must have been magic night that we met. If I hadn't stopped you, I'd always regret.
It's Nemo here, and I'd like to choose Magic from the Driving Rain album, because it's Paul in uncharacteristically downbeat mood, reflecting on the lucky twist of fate, the chance encounter that changed his life the night he met Linda. For me, the song captures the sadness of losing someone close, but it's also bittersweet because you're left with the consolation of memories of happier times together. The lugubrious sound of the track and Paul's vocal perfectly match the mournful tone and the heartfelt sentiment of the lyrics, leaving me helpless, not knowing why. I think it's an incredible recording, and each time I hear it, I find it moving. It's also an instance of Paul reflecting the whole range of life experience, not just the optimistic attitude he's better known for. Pure magic.
Oh, darling.
This is Stephanie Spinetti, and my contribution to the McCartney Project for the Egg Pod is the song Oh Darling. Oh Darling is one of the songs that I feel gets overlooked quite easily, but it's a powerhouse of a song. I was sad that Paul didn't include it in his lyrics book that he released in 2021. It was one of the songs that I looked forward to reading about the most, but it did make me happy to see a snippet of him recording the demo in the Get Back documentary. And how he recorded it on the last day that they were at Twickenham, it dawned on me that the lyrics, "When you told me you didn't need me anymore, well, you know I nearly broke down and cried," might have been about George leaving the group recently. I feel this song is more than just an ode to doo-wop and Little Richard rock and roll soulfulness, but it's about heartbreak. Aside from being one of my go-to karaoke songs, Oh Darling is one of those songs that is simple, but also doesn't fail to showcase McCartney's brilliance, and that's why it's one of my favorites.
When I'm walking beside her, people tell me I'm lucky. Yes, I know I'm a lucky guy.
Hi, Chris. I've chosen a stone-cold classic Lennon and McCartney track. It's mainly written by Paul, but it was sung by John. Unbelievably, it's been hidden away on side two of Beatles for Sale, and it's the best thing on the album. It's, of course, Every Little Thing. I love this song, the mood, the excitement, and especially the boom-boom of the timpani. It's the sound of my heart skipping a beat. It's my favourite, favourite Beatles track. I bloody love it.
Oh, some things in life are hard to bear. Don't let it bring you down.
My name's Richard Black, and my pick is Don't Let It Bring You Down from London Town. I love the way Paul puts across a really straightforward message, basically saying, don't worry, things will get better, which, coming from someone who's so rich and successful and talented, it's kind of easy to dismiss it. But the combination of the atmosphere of the recording and the sort of folky arrangement and brilliant singing, it all works. And the choice of words is perfect. Things seem strange, but they change. I find it's genuinely reassuring to listen to.
I'm Welbeck Kane, some of the time, and I choose Front Parlour from McCartney 2. On one hand, it sounds like it took Paul less time to write than it takes to actually listen to, something that he didn't spend all that long on. But despite that, it still manages to sound like he's initially melancholy and wistful for times past before coming to realise he's content with what he's got. If he can't be in the Beatles, he's happy to be in his front parlour. Also, towards the end, it really starts to remind me of the theme tune to Simon and the Witch.
Once there was a way to get back homeward. Once there was a way to get back home. Sleep, pretty darling. And I will sing a lullaby.
Comedy scriptwriter Sara Gibbs
What song have you picked?
I have picked Golden Slumbers, Carry That Weight, The End. So more of a medley than a song. And yeah, it's a bit of an odd one because obviously there's the controversy over whether or not it was the end, so to speak. I guess not controversy, but disagreement amongst fans. But also it's got a lot of personal resonance for me. So sort of a dual track going on about why I chose that.
Yeah, so let's hear why. Why did you pick this?
So the Beatles, for me, the interest mainly is because it's really emblematic of my relationship with my dad, who passed away almost a decade ago now. But he was a huge, huge Beatles fan, was like just the right age growing up, you know, born in the sort of early mid-50s, was a teenager working in a music shop and really, really loved the Beatles. And so a lot of hearing the Beatles songs for the first time was through him singing them to me rather than actually hearing the songs themselves. And this medley in particular was one that he sung to me and my brother every night at bedtime. It was like a lullaby. And he would be all the instruments. So this is long a cappella version where, you know, he would really get into it and we would be sort of jumping up and down in our beds and singing along. And then he'd sort of calm us down with that last little couplet of "and in the end," and then he'd just add on a little "Your Majesty" as an encore, and that was every single night, and that was my childhood. So that's why I chose this.
Did he do the guitar solos?
He did. Doon 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 every night, and we would just be so. And then the drums would come doon 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 doon. For a kid who had sleep issues, it was like Glastonbury right before bed. I went to a Steiner school, so we didn't have like TV or anything. This was as good as it got, and it really sort of wound us up energetically. And they'd be like, "Why isn't she sleeping?" but it was wonderful. And what's odd about this song and again my relationship with my dad is how it's followed us around. So right before he passed away, I was in the hospice with him every day, and I just clicked on to Happy Feet on the TV and found that they were singing the words "and in the end, the love you take." And I remember it just, you know, being like an arrow to the heart in that moment. It was in his last few days even, and it was so, you know, such an odd thing to happen. And then bizarrely, like, you know, I'm not really like a religious or spiritual person, but what's very odd is right after we had the conversation where I suggested doing this medley, I put on the anthology, which I was in the middle of watching, and it skipped randomly to a bit that just because it's something glitched, and it skipped to the bit where they were talking about recording this medley right [S2] Wow. [S1] After we'd had that conversation. Literally, I closed Twitter, put the anthology on, and boom, skipped there like a glitch. So it felt very poignant and like it was sort of meant to be.
Golden slumbers fill your eyes, smiles awake you when you rise. Sleep, pretty darling, do not cry, and I will sing a lullaby.
Because the song, I mean, Paul is now known for his medleys. He's done quite a few. But the first two sections don't have John on.
Because he had a car crash.
That's it, yeah. But it's lovely that he is there on the third section. So they are reunited.
Yeah, and what I love about it is that everyone gets their moment. Everyone has their solo. It's a real sort of, it's a real celebration of who the Beatles were as individuals and as a group, you know, how they, when they allowed each other those moments to shine individually and celebrated each other's talent in that way. That's what made them so great. And that's what I love about this. And I always feel like for me, this is the real spiritual ending to the Beatles. Like, I know that people probably disagree and, you know, there's a lot of discussion over Let It Be being the final album because, you know, some of it was recorded in 1970, it was released later, but for me this feels like, it feels like Paul McCartney singing about the end of the Beatles to me, and I don't know if that was intentional on his part.
Because originally he, I mean, there's the old story about he, the lyrics were taken from the Thomas Dekker sheet music. But on the Get Back session, you can hear him singing. And it's Once There Was a King.
Oh, so that was, drove me mad. Yeah. I was so angry.
Well, and Carry That Weight was even worse, actually, the original lyrics to that. It's about Hangover. But it's very much, at that point, it was golden slumbers. I'm guessing in his head he was thinking, you know, something you could sing to a kid, a fairy tale, but evolved into something huge.
Epic. But, you know, even the words, carry that weight, you know, boy, you're going to carry that weight a long time. You know, when we're put in that context of that, that was, you know, arguably one of the last things that, that they were intended to do together. I know that, that they say that they didn't intend it, that, you know, there's sort of an ever-changing narrative about whether or not they knew they were breaking up. And so, you know, sometimes some of them said they felt it, and others, you know, I think thought it would go on for longer. But you know, that he really has, you know, he's 80 now and he's carried that weight a long time.
Because to me, it's, you know, the Beatles are going to split and then you've got to try and move on with your life after that. That is one hell of a weight to carry with their solo careers.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think they all handled it in various degrees of, you know, difficulty or... But what's so amazing about Paul is, I think, more than any of them, he became the custodian of... He really understands who he is culturally. He really gets it. And you see it in footage of when he meets people or in their anecdotes about him. He puts on a show. He knows that he needs to be that Paul McCartney, that Beatle Paul, that myth. And he understands what people and what the world wants from him. And I think that's, you know, that's quite a burden to carry in himself. And, you know, even stories like mine, where it's so wrapped up in people's personal relationships and you know, and things are so raw and personal, and people must just come and trauma dump on him all the time, not just the loss of the Beatles, but, you know, carrying the weight of the world's expectations as well. I just think he's amazing.
I do agree with you. For me, the whole suite does sound like the final Beatles song, and it's lovely that George Martin is all over this.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think, obviously, you know, the Phil Spector thing, we can the less said about the better. But you know, it wouldn't... I think that's another reason that it feels like the last Beatles thing for me, is because, you know, the Beatles don't quite feel complete to me without George Martin.
Yeah, his orchestration on this is just sumptuous. It's so good.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one man alone cannot do it justice, I have since learned.
I love Jeff Emerick. He was talking about the end, and he said, "The thing that always amused me was how much persuasion it took to get Ringo to play that solo. Usually you have to talk drummers out of doing solos. He didn't want to do it, but everyone said, 'No, no, no, it'll be fantastic.' So he gave in and turned in a bloody marvellous performance." And it is, when you think about it, technically, I'm sure super-duper drummers could knock that out in a second, but it's just so right, isn't it? It's just so perfect. Sorry talking about Ringo, but...
No. I didn't know that. I actually didn't know that. Do you know why he didn't want to do it?
You know, I don't know. It's insecurity, I guess.
God, imagine being a Beatles and being insecure. I mean, I know they were, you know, John quite famously didn't like the sound of his voice, but like it's mad to think that you can be the biggest band in the world and that there will ever be and still doubt your own. It's quite nice, actually, you know, in terms of like being a creative and your own imposter syndrome, to think that, hey, maybe I'm a Beatle and I just don't know. Yeah. Probably not. Yeah. But, you know, if they have imposter syndrome, maybe mine's nonsense.
Again, veering away from Paul, I've got my theory about John's voice. When they stopped touring in 66, so John, most of the time, he'd be singing in front of a screaming crowd, getting all that feedback from the crowd and reassurance, and he probably couldn't hear what was going on anyway. But when they were in the studio, he's singing, the only person whose feedback he's getting is from Paul, who's, you know, can do anything with his voice. And I'm sure that's where his insecurities started, because he's now in the studio and the only feedback he'll get is criticism.
Yeah, and your own ears as well. It's like the thing that nobody tells you about recording for the first time, because I was in a band for a while, and you go in and you're like, Oh no! It's like, you know, holding one of those greasy paw mirror. The mirror isn't greasy, but holding one of those mirrors up to your paws. You know, that there's like really intense high zoom mirrors, and you can see every little pore in your skin. You're like, oh, I'm hideous. And it's like no one is looking at you that closely, but it's the audio equivalent. And also, Paul McCartney, bless his heart, is, you know, he's laser focused on the task and making it the best it can possibly be. And I understand I'm a pull professionally, and I drive people up the wall, being, you know, a pull type, a very type A, very driven, want, you know, like pushing everyone to the limit, and not always understanding that, like, stop, they need to hear that they're good as well. And you know, I can imagine Paul was quite a stressful presence in that way, where he might point out if you've made a mistake, but not be like, oh, and also you're one of the best rock and roll singers of all time, don't worry about it.
There's another quote I love about, sorry to focus so much on the guitar solos, but hey, Jeff Emerick, he was saying, the idea for guitar solos is very spontaneous. And everybody said, yes, definitely. Well, except for George, who was a little apprehensive at first. But he saw how excited John and Paul were, so he went along with it. And I think, again, that we saw that in the Get Back footage, where George was talking about Eric Clapton, saying, oh, he's a much better guitarist than me. George's solo on the end, they're brilliant, absolutely brilliant. But yeah, again, the insecurity.
I think George is someone who needed time to work stuff out. You know, he really needed to, like, he wasn't someone who could just, like, Paul, things just flowed out of him. But what about an intro? He's like, oh, what, like this? And then just casually plays, you know, the intro to one of the most famous songs of all time. And that's it. And it just came, you know, like, I don't know if it was a little something he prepared earlier, but I don't think it was. People, I guess, learn and create in different ways. Like, in I'm a comedy writer in a writer's room. I'm the person who needs quiet and time. I'm not the person spitting out hilarious ideas left, right, and center. And, like, you know, often don't get asked back, but get a lot of material on the show, because in the room I wasn't delivering the goods, but I had to sit and focus. And I think George is that. I really empathize with that feeling of insecurity of, like, having all these geniuses around you who are just spitballing, and it's coming so naturally to them, and it's not, you know, he has to sit and think about it.
Very much so. Sarah Gibbs, what does the Golden Slumbers medley mean to you?
Oh, I mean, it's, you know, it's the sound of my childhood, and it's every happy memory with my dad, and, you know, that I guess that my biggest regret is not recording him singing it and not having that. I wish I'd done that, but, you know, I the Beatles are a close runner-up, I guess. They'll do. They're all right, aren't they?
Yeah. And finally, Paul McCartney at 80. Why do you think his music has endured for all these years?
Honestly, I think Paul is just some sort of space alien that got left here from some musical planet far beyond it. He is a chameleon in every sense of the word. He can do absolutely anything. He can hear a piece of music or a style of music, and he can emulate it. He can emulate the singing. You know, even when you hear him goofing around in the Get Back sessions, and in the tapes, you hear him singing Besame Mucho and his opera voice, and then he'll go into his Little Richard voice, and then I guess there's the vocal, you know, I guess versatility of him, but also the songwriting. He never stopped evolving, even in the sort of McCartney 2 era, which I heard the Beardy Man. That was my introduction to McCartney 2, was that episode, and I was like, what is this? And now I honestly have not stopped listening to Temporary Secretary for weeks, and that's the genius of Paul McCartney. Even when he's terrible, he's amazing.
Sarah Gibbs, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been joyous.
Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you can come back for part 3 with lots more guests and lots more Macca favourites. Bye. Hey!